Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is World Forms and Fighting Champion John Chung, and you're listening to the AMAA Legends and Pioneers Radio Blog Show with Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives, protecting the history one warrior at a time. Enjoy.
Good evening, everyone. Professor Gary Lee here in the Sport Karate Museum in your home on a Tuesday evening. We got an incredible show tonight and a very, very special guest. I'll be bringing him on in a little bit. But, you know, we got so much to talk about tonight. And I'm going to start off the bat with what happened this past weekend. We had the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Atlanta this weekend put on by Mr. Joe Corley and Mr. Ruth, who actually promoted the tournament. Mr. Corley promoted the Eternal Warrior Awards and brought in 50 years of the Battle of Atlanta and 40 years of the PKA. I was graciously treated very, very, very kindly by Mr. Corley by allowing me to have a beautiful exhibition tables set up at the very front, so every legend had to go by the Sport Karate Museum booth. And it just was an incredible moment. It was like Christmas morning, and you knew all your presents, what they were, before you opened them. That's how joyful it was. Some of the things that happened was I had the honor of getting signatures on this incredible 1977 full contact poster that was given to me by Mr. Danny McCall, and who I hadn't seen in 40 years since I last seen him, and we had a war with each other in the ring. But in that time, we've become friends, and God, it was so nice to see him. We also got to see so many legends of the martial arts. Dr. Manji was there. Of course, Mr. Jeff Smith and Mr. Bill Wallace were the ones who actually invited people to be put into the Eternal Warrior Awards that was honored Mr. Joe Lewis. If I said one name, I'd have to say everybody, and it's hard because there was probably about 200 people in that room that night that were being sharing that moment of 40 years of history. And a big shout-out to Mr. Joe Corley for his love for the martial arts, his individual style for what he did for all of us. And I'm excited because we also found and inducted some new history generals, Mr. Isaacs, Mr. Jerry Beasley, some really cool people that I've been wanting to be involved with the Sport Karate Museum for quite a while. You know, we're real excited about what's going on in the Sport Karate and what Mr. Ruth is doing with the Battle of Atlanta, and we wish him many, many years of success, as much success as Mr. Corley did. Thank you again, Mr. Corley, for a great, great weekend. And personally, Mr. Smith, Mr. Wallace, and Mr. Corey, thank you personally for the Eternal Warrior Award to remember Mr. Joe Lewis. Well, you know, I would like to remind you that last weekend we started part one of an incredible story that's going to be turned into a movie, and it's called Memoirs of American Samurai. If you remember last week, it started off with 29 samurai that were sailed out from Edo, Japan, and they got lost, and they landed on a deserted island that was off the charts. You know, 5 years went by, and no one had appeared, and then 10 years, and still no sign of anyone or any help. Meanwhile, these stranded samurais and the ship tradesmen began to build a port city for the coming Japanese reinforcements, you know, that never materialized. Although a few generations later, merchant ships that were off course saw their beacon and headed toward that light began showing up at their outpost port. When these merchants returned to their home, ports bringing exciting stories about these fierce-looking samurai warriors encountered on the island ship captains, and their pilots added this island and this port to their current nautical maps. You know, thus the island's commerce, well, the commerce began. On the maps and charts, they named the island Katana, which referred to everyone wearing a katana sword. Was originally thought to be a Hajima actually became the newly charted Anab Katana, located off the farthest northwestern tip of Hawaii, and which was announced by the United States of America. Thus, the inhabitants of the island became known as American Samurai. You know, the story begins generations earlier when the great Hadzimon Katana had discovered a piece of fallen heaven. This was a find of metal so powerful it emitted an eerie black glow. It captured its energy by forging this ethereal metal into a special blade. After each and every pounded foe gave the strength and power, Hadzimon thrust the red-hot link of this unworldly metal into the cold water to quench and set it. Upon cooling, the carbon crust magically appeared. He then collected these particles of crust and sprinkled these bits into his daily rice and tea, which he ate with great gusto. He sincerely believed that the ingesting of these bits of metal, he would become an extension of this magical blade and as powerful as it once was. Every day as he consumed his rice laced with the collected particles, he felt himself become stronger and more powerful, both mentally and physically. To understand the complete, you know, how he could use his new gotten powers by using his forged blade, he then ventured out into the bamboo jungle. And he began cutting each and every stalk of bamboo. Slice, slice, slap, slash. He returned 30 days later, both physically and mentally morphed into a Herculean samurai. His eyes had become like burning pieces of dark black coal. This new and still power instantly gave him an advantage over man. He lived to be 114 years old, still retaining his powerful legacy by the way of a written lore and many duels to the death. You know, as tales would become history, there was an ancient rumor that a male was born with those special boring black eyes immediately after Uzumah's death. During that time, the emperor had become knowledgeable and probably frightened with the Katana clan. He knew they were a threat, as he knew how powerful they could become and how they been. And they could be in the future. The emperor, in his wisest and self-preserving moments, had the entire Katana clan removed from Japan and sent to the outer reaches of the realm. This mysterious young offspring of the great Hadzimon had sailed with the Katana clan to this remote inhabited island. Within a few months, a camp was set up and eventually a port established. Tadashi Katana is the last living descendant of the great leader and the samurai warrior. Hadzimon Katana, whose ancestors first landed on the island 100 years earlier, Tadashi spent his youth practicing the traditional ways of his ancestor, an ancient warrior. Ways where the jungles and the beaches met. One side of the field was white sand, and the other side of the field was a dense green jungle, in which he became the master of his surroundings, with or without a blade. Tadashi Sensei also inherited special DNA, which was passed down to him, and only to him. When Tadashi came of age, he lived and studied abroad. He learned to speak several languages, able to discuss any topic or discipline, excelled in any sport or endeavor. Considered by all to be a man of his ages, he was comfortable dealing with people from all walks of life, which prepared him for his biggest challenge, and that was to move to Texas. Protecting history, one warrior at a time, the Sport Carter Museum archives. And that will be the beginning story of the vision of the American samurai watching sport karate grow in America, telling the stories of how it became part of America's lifestyle in the 60s and the 70s, how it became the heyday in the 80s, how it changed in the 90s, and where it is today. The American Samurai story turned to be a movie. Thank you, Dana Abbott, for creating the character that is true to the heart. Well, listen, boys and girls, my listeners, my animal friends, and my Black Belt fans, I hope you paid attention and understand that this is going to be a great, great adventure. I have a very special guest tonight, and speaking of things that I think that people push the limit to make things happen for other people, this man reminds me of this. His name is Silky Dave Johnson, and are you on the line, Dave?
Yes, sir, go ahead.
How'd you like the story?
Yeah, that was cool. I could actually kind of start seeing the movie in my mind.
That's what I want to see. And you know what? I'd love to get your mentorship on anything because I appreciate your history and who you are. Welcome to the show. welcome to the Parts Unknown Show, Sookie Dave Johnson. It's a pleasure to have you. And I understand you spent the past few weeks in Europe on a tour, and you just got back yesterday, correct?
Yeah, got back just in time.
Well, where are some of the cities that you went to?
Well, I have a couple schools in Germany that run my system, the SAEDO system. And so we do camps. I rotate what we call the elite black belt camps. They're pretty intense, 2 to 4 days. And I move them around from Brazil to Argentina, Peru, Chile. And this time it was in Germany. It was camp number 16. So I conducted that in kind of the southwest part of Germany. And then from there, me and my senior black belts and over to London. It was pretty incredible time.
Well, that sounds exciting. Well, you know, before we kind of go into how you built camps and you had schools in Germany, let's tell my listeners how you got started in martial arts. How old were you when you made black belt, and where did you start training, and who was your first black belt instructor?
Wow. Well, my first black belt instructor was Al Reyes in the Cajacampo system in 1959. That was in near Fairfield, California. Anyway, and that was my introduction. I also then went on to study Shotokan under Sensei Cruz. He just passed away, unfortunately.
Yes,
Vincent Cruz, just a couple of years ago. But what a man. What a great leader in the Shotokan system. But anyway, that's where I started. I did black belt, so probably, I think, 28. And actually, Taekwondo was my first black belt because I had moved from different systems. And I was very young. So there were big gaps in between different systems I studied in. So anyway.
How old were you when you were black belt? How old were you? Dave?
Did you hear me? Yeah,
28. 28. Okay, cool. And that was in Fresno, California?
That was in Fresno.
Fresno. Now, do you remember my old friend, Mr. Stuart Kwan, who passed away a few years back? He was from Fresno, California. You're breaking up, Dave. You got a good connection? Are you good power in your phone?
Try to move a little bit.
Because you're breaking up on me.
Yeah. Now, can you hear me clear now?
I can hear you nice and clear now.
Okay.
Are we good?
Yeah, me and Stuart.
Okay, super. Yeah.
Yeah, me and Stuart had a lot of great times together, a lot of years, a lot of memories, as well as
great.
His sister, Kathy, was also a great martial artist here in Fresno. But, yeah, wonderful man.
Yeah, Mr. Stewart was also, he was in the movies. He was in Big Trouble in Little China. One of the top competitors and rated in the 80s and 82, 83. And we lost him to a heart attack. Now, also in Fresno area, did you know the Halliburtons? Did you know Halliburton?
Did.
Like, oh, wow.
Sure did.
Robert Halliburton.
Yep.
He was a tough competitor, too. You know he spent some time in Texas. Did you know that? He worked down there with Jim Arwood in a place called Japan Ways in Houston, Texas. And my instructor, Mr. George Minshew, actually worked out with those guys too. So lots of cool memories that worked in a circle together, huh? Pretty cool. Now, you said you trained in Shotokan. Did you train with people like Nakamura and Oshimi and Nakamura?
No,
you know, the traditional Japanese guys?
No, never got to, unfortunately. Never got to. Because I left Shotokan as a very young child and went into another system of Kung Fu that my older brother was in. And then from there went to several systems of Taekwondo. I spent 11 years in Aikido and went back to Taekwondo. And, you know,
you're a real martial artist. You bounced around and learned a lot of different things. That's pretty cool. That's cool.
I know I'm not the only one that tells the story, but back in the 80s, I had a couple pretty large commercial schools in Central California, and we would teach Aikido, We would teach Taekwondo. We would teach Harangdo, Hapkido. And that was mixed martial arts, but now mixed martial arts means something else, I guess. But we were doing it way, way back then.
Now, what do you do now as far as the style that you teach now?
I teach primarily my system called Seido.
Okay, explain now what that is and tell me about that.
Right. It's an eclectic blend of my history of martial arts. I do still teach the strict, real, traditional Taekwondo and keep the system going and black belt people and do testing and so forth. I'm a 7th Dan Kukiwan. Promotable, 8th Dan promotable. I'm still working on getting ready for my 8th Dan right now from Taekwondo in Korea. But we do that on the side, but I really love Seido. And Seido really got started out of a need that I saw. I'm an ex-law enforcement officer, and I was doing a lot of executive protection work. And I noticed, I had probably 30 years, 35 years maybe in martial arts already. And I realized that all the stuff that is taught in traditional schools was not going to work in the real world. And I became a state law enforcement instructor. And when I got through all my training to become a state law enforcement instructor, I realized they were doing stuff way better. And so I kind of mixed what I knew from martial arts that would work with the new curriculum that the state had and then created some new stuff. But it was basically a blend of that that came about that I put together that I call Seido, which is the meaning means the elite path of mastery in Japanese. But and that's how it started. And then from then it's a long story of how it got around the world. Now I'm all over the place. I have a school in China, schools in Germany, and then schools in Brazil, Peru, Chile, Argentina, and Uruguay right now.
Now I want to ask you a question, go back to law enforcement, because this is, I've got many, many people, many friends of mine that are involved with law enforcement. And I ask them the same question. You've seen the change where back in the 70s and the 80s, where you went to a police officer because you need help, and you could always trust that person that he would help you as much as he could. And you can still do that today. Most of us feel still that way. But also, today, law enforcement officer, he knows that he's a target for all these people who are, I guess he's radical, who made decisions that law enforcement is their target. How do you feel the martial arts, and because you're involved with both, has affected the martial art community within the law enforcement community where they're because I know a lot of martial artists are law enforcement. I know a lot of law enforcement are black belts. And you think that they use their skills easily on the street, or were they more hesitant to pull a gun?
The real issue is that they're not getting enough training presently. And in fact, I just got off a phone with a longtime friend of mine that we do private training together. We do the concealed weapons training. We do all kinds of from sniper to assault rifles training. But we're actually working on meeting with the local law enforcement administration because of the long-going problem that I'm talking about, and that is officers get, 8 hours, 16 hours a year on hand-to-hand type control situations. I was a cop, I saw it, and then I'm as a teacher, I saw it. It's always been that way. It all comes down to money. They don't have the money to spend on the training. Therefore, the officers get very, very little. Like you said, there's a lot of them that do have black belts, and that's just an added plus to them for their career and while they're on the street. Big, big plus. But unfortunately, the majority of officers don't have any training or they have very, very little training. And that's something that I'm putting a lot of time into right now. It's a real focus of mine to figure out a way to get these officers a lot more training on their own, be able to handle themselves to use these techniques on the street. I've got several officers I've been teaching for years out here at my own residence out in the country. We teach privately, and I've got SWAT team officers that I work with, but they do it on their own. And we're trying to reach more people. Because unfortunately, most of the stuff you see in the news that have given law enforcement a bad name is the abuse. Some of it is outright bad.
Dave, how can we change the attitude of the general public toward our law enforcement? They are there to help us. Bothers me too. It bothers me that a kid. Here's what bothers me, Dave, and I'm sharing this with you because I really I felt connected to you when we got inducted at the Hall of Fame a few years back, and I met you. And I felt a connection to you that I could talk to you about this. So I want to show this, ask you a question. Yeah, how do we change the attitude, for instance, our kids, to not to go to school and feel that they're going to get shot? To tell the law enforcement officers how to help these kids get educated to believe in them again. That's what I'm trying to say. To make that faith to believe in that police officer again.
Yeah, I think there's a couple different things we can do and need to do, and they're trying to do, and that is the community involvement. I teach at two universities, and I teach law enforcement management as a professor in college. And one of the things we teach a lot today to the new officers is how important community involvement is. I mean, face-to-face communication, going to block parties, going to barbecue with the kids in their neighborhood, talking to kids on a one-on-one level. And there's a lot of that being done. We can do more of that. We got to continue that. And then the other part of that is what we're doing is, unfortunately, we're battling the social media engine. That's a big deal. We never had this before, back when I was a cop back in the 70s. But now this is a huge monster that turns everything negative, the way the media is. They twist it, spin it the way they want. And so these kids, that's all they see is the bad cop, bad cop, bad cop. That's really unfortunate. So the other thing that I was talking about earlier is if we can increase the training to these officers to the hand-to-hand ability, because when I see the stuff on the news, my heart breaks because I think, that guy did that. He slammed him down or he did this or he hit him because he didn't know the techniques. That's a huge thing that bothers me. If I could get these guys to spend more hours training with control techniques, joint locks and so forth, we would not see these panic strikes, because they're trying to protect themselves. I understand. I feel bad for them. But because they're not getting enough training, those skills, they might have saw it once or twice a year or maybe once in the academy. They can't do that under stress situations. They're not going to be able to perform good, effective, close quarter.
You know, I think, Dave, I think people forget that policemen are human too.
Right.
They go home every night. They have families. They cry. They laugh. I've always put a police officer higher because he sacrifices. He gives.
Oh, yeah.
And, I respect the high level of a from a homicide detective to the grunt, we call the guy that works on the street. Because those guys, they live a hard, hard life. And they wear the badge as much as the guy that wears the homicide detective. And everyone is important. So I'm just saying that we got to get our kids back in the attitude of respecting the police officers again. And, I appreciate your opinion. It means so much. Now, let me ask you a question. You say you teach at two universities. And these are young kids between the ages of 18 to 22. Do you find that their attitude toward the martial arts is cocky because they're all UFC oriented now? Because I know you're a traditional martial artist. I know that. Do you find that these kids have a different attitude toward martial arts now?
Sadly, a majority do. It seems like I'll get maybe one at a class or two that get it and they have the right view, and they'll wait after class, or they're interested to talk to me. They respect my history, my knowledge, and they're just a sponge. And you can tell they want to talk to me. But the majority are like, yeah, we know everything. Yeah, it's a different generation. It's tough sometimes for me in the current university type teaching environment. I'm 63, almost 64, so I'm in my 60s. And I come from back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and I was in the old law enforcement days, like Barney Fife kind of stuff. So it's the real world. Today,
Barney Fife. For my young listeners who are just heard him say Barney Fife, there used to be a man named Andy Griffith. He had a show, and he was a sheriff of Mayberry. And there you go. And Barney was the assistant sheriff to Andy and Mayberry, and he got into everything. I love Barney.
Don Knotts. My favorite line was, Andy, give me my bullet.
Yeah, he had one bullet, and he wouldn't ever let him use it. I remember. Oh, that's great. Hey, I'm going to take a short break here, and I'm going to bring you back, and I want to talk about your elite Hall of Fame that you do and how that got started.
Sure.
So stay with me, and I'll bring you right back. Okay, Dave. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm with Chucky Dave Johnson, and we're talking about his league history and some of the things he's done, and incredible things he's done in the past and what he's going to do in the future. What he's done presently with this Hall of Fame, we'll bring back in just a minute. I just got the word that everyone's going to be able to get a free T-shirt if you purchase the 2018 Martial Arts Masters and Pioneers autograph book. That's right. That's really cool. If you are interested in getting the book, if you purchase it during the show and call in, Hansi Bowen at 919-618-8075. It's our push, proud to be a martial artist. And we're going to be doing it for the next few shows. If you're proud to be a martial artist, endorse it by getting a free T-shirt and ordering your 2018 Martial Arts Masters of Pioneers autograph book. Now, remember that we are the AMA Masters Network, and we have various shows. We got Gwen Bowen with her spiritual show. We got Hansi Jesse Bowen with his mindfulness show. We got the incredible, incredible Karen Eden Herdman, who does her show for just a little bit of everything, but it's just so cool to listen to her talk. And of course, we got the Sport Karate Museum show that we're doing tonight. Now, I want you to understand that we also support some of our affiliates, and one of the people I really love, and I love the sport, and I'm going to say it to him, it's called Power. That's right, Power, baby. And that's Mr. Alex Reyes and the Point Fighter Karate Hero. If you want to find out about the latest information in sport karate in America, go to Point Fighter Radio on Facebook, and he'll have all the details on the upcoming tournaments and all kinds of clips and just things that you can participate in. Alex Reyes is one of those guys that really cares about our sport, and he shows it by putting together this incredible program called Point Fighter Radio. Now, I've also got a little shout-out tonight, and we like to do this on our weekly basis. There's a karate studio in Fulshear, Texas, and it's called Fulshear Karate. It's run by Mr. Wade Kirkpatrick, and he is a Golden Greek winner, an NBO world champion. And for more information, if you're in the Fulshear area, Katy area, or the Sugarland area, look up Mr. Wade Kirkpatrick at Fulshear Karate. Look him up on Facebook. You know, we got to remember that upcoming events are coming up, and we got some plugs. Very, very excited about 2 weeks. We'll be in Las Vegas at the Super Show for Century. This is at the Las Vegas Bellagio. That's right. And it'll be July the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Special guest will be Mr. Jim Buten, Ms. Linda Denley, and we'll be having our book there. Of course, Mr. Buten will have his book. Ms. Denley will be signing autographs. By the way, if you don't know, Jim Buten was one of the first Americans to be on the famous Taekwondo team. And, of course, Linda Denley is the amazing, amazing Linda Denley. People have said that she is probably the best fighter that's ever put on again sport karate. Definitely the best woman sport karate fighter. And this will be July 1st, 2nd, 3rd. Las Vegas, Super Show, come by our booth, please. And we've got some great things just for you if you just come by and say hello. August the 3rd, Legends Who Sue Masters and Pioneer Autograph Book Banquet. Also in conjunction with the U.S. Clappings and Dennis Brown. Also his Kung Fu Tournament. This is a major weekend, August 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Special guests are confirmed. Dan Severn, UFC, the Beast, that's right. The one and only Cynthia Rothrock, Miss Linda Denley, the greatest traditional form chef to ever live, Mr. John Chung. That's right, they'll be there. And then, of course, my special editor and author and creator of the character I just read about to you earlier, Mr. Dana Abbott, will be there also. It'll be August 3rd in Washington, D.C. For more information, please contact, please, Dennis Brown on the Master Sugar Master website or Mr. Jesse Bowen at Facebook. Now, August the 16th and 17th and 18th, Universal Hall of Fame, Houston, Texas. Please contact Severo Guerrero. This is one of the oldest Black Belt Hall of Fames in existence and one of the most fun. We'll be there this year. I'll be doing personal seminars. The museum have a 3-day exhibit. This is also produced by one of the great, great legends of martial arts, Mr. Daryl Bigfoot Stewart, been the arbitrator for the National Black Belt League for almost 20 years. For more information, please contact Mr. Severo Guerrero on Facebook. And that's the Universal Black Belt Hall of Fame. September 8th, we'll be in Houston, not really Pasadena, part of Houston. putting on a tournament for the AOK called Mr. Zinti Ahmed. We're putting on this tournament. For more information, contact him on Facebook. The Bushidban headquarters in Pasadena, and that's September 8th. Now, I've been talking a lot, haven't I? Well, I'm excited. I'm going to slow down a little bit because I've got to share with you that, you know, a few years back, we put together a thing called the Pitching Black. It was under all the women in martial arts. It was a lot of work, and I loved doing it. The museum staff loved doing it. We learned a lot of lessons, and 5 years later, this year, we decided to do it again, to honor the power of women. And we also are going to be roasting one of the legends of Point Karate, Ms. Machiro Moore. But we have a lot more. We have Kata Wars, the Pro Division Kata Wars, which have been most talked about event in American history, really, because you got to have first places to be invited. You have 100 first places to just be a judge. Who's got 100 first places? Well, we know. We've invited them for the Pro Division. We have an open tournament for everybody, and that'll be Saturday. And this is September the 28th and 29th in Houston, Texas. Now, we also have something else we're introducing this year that we're really excited about, and it's called the Jim Harrison America's Challenge, where we've handpicked eight fighters. They also have to have 100 first places under their belt to even be invited. And the judges, they're going to be judging the Showtime event for the roast that night. They have to have 100 first places, too, just to be a judge. It'll be tag team. Two men facing each other. Two women facing each other. It's going to be so much fun. And you know what? On top of that, we changed the rule a little bit. One-point punch, two-point kick, no groin. But no center referee has to say so. He just has to break it apart. If three out of four judges see a fighter hit the other fighter 3 to 4 to 5 times before the center referee pulls them apart, those judges are going to give that fighter 3 points. Yeah, interesting stuff. The Jim Harrison's American Challenge for the Showtime. For the banquet, Saturday night, September 29th. More information, please call Professor Gary or the Sport Karate Museum. It's 713-483-0476. Or contact for the Women's Symposium and the Power of Women, put on by Michelle and Darlene McPherson-Pagels. Contact her, please, at 281-221-2145. Guest speakers include Colonel Phil Torres, talking about safety, gun control, and being able to carry a gun in Texas and how to be safety with it. World champion Dean Piles and his loving daughter Alex Piles, world champion, putting on an incredible hands-on workshop for the Women's Symposium. Terry Lawson, an assistant principal teacher, talking about today's society and bullying. We've got engineers, we've got doctors, we've got incredible women of the martial arts, not only including the bot belts, the champions that we found throughout America for the past 2 years to bring them together for this moment. September 28th and 29th, Houston, Texas. Please give us a call. Now, coming back to our guest, our special guest, Sookie Dave Johnson. Dave, are you there, sir?
Yes, sir. Good.
Very good. Well, you know, I got one more segment, but I want to talk to you about your elite, am I saying it right, Elite Hall of Fame? Is that the correct name of it?
Right. Well, we renamed it after the first event was called the Elite Black Belt Hall of Fame, but we just call it now the Hall of Masters.
Hall of Masters. Okay. Now, tell me how that started. What was the creation and why, and how long has it been going on?
It started because I had been inducted, like many of the martial artists today, in all these different types of Hall of Fames, like the USA Martial Art Hall of Fame, Alan Goldberg's Action Martial Arts Hall of Fame, the Masters Hall of Fame, and on and on and on. And I went to them, and they were fun, and there's nothing wrong with it. They're doing it great. But what I noticed is they weren't – I just felt that they weren't really recognizing old-school, long-term, legitimate, ranked martial art masters and grandmasters. I saw a huge void there. And so that was my initial purpose, just to do a small event and recognize really well-known, well-documented true masters and grandmasters. And we did the first one in 2014. And it turned out to be an amazing event. And so that I didn't want to do it every year like the rest of them, because I wanted it to be really carefully selected individuals, not needed like a numbers to break even or make money or something. So the second one we did was just this last year in 2017, October. And at this, only planning on one more, and that's 2020. And then I'm done for, you know, for my, I figured at my age and all the history I have and all the people I know, I should have pretty well recognized all the old greats, basically. And then I'm done. Again, I'm not trying to do it year after year after year. I'm just doing it in a different way. It's not putting down anybody, not meant to do that. It's just, I just saw a segment and a void and a need to recognize these people legitimately with really nice awards.
So what are the qualifications for someone? What are the qualifications for someone to be part of your Hall of Fame?
Well, they have to be a master that I can corroborate. You know, I can do a vetting process on, and really kind of, a lot of them I already knew. I've known for so many years. I know they are. I don't have to vet them. But if anybody I don't know, and I've had people send me names, I start researching them and do my own research to find out if they really, really are legitimately ranked, who ranked them, and so forth. And then they'll be invited. And a lot of people got angry because they wanted to, why can't I go? Why can't I get inducted? Why can't I buy a ticket? It's just not that. Mine's just different. It's a very selective Hall of Fame.
People actually got angry at you? They got angry?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't understand. What do you mean by angry?
Well, you know, and you've been around a long time, too. It's like there's people out there who say they're masters and grandmasters, but they really aren't. They're not legitimately ranked.
Let me ask you a question, Dave, let me ask you a question, little brother. Let me ask you a question. Do you see something wrong with the fact that someone would call you up and get mad because they're not invited to a Butthole Hall of Fame? I always thought, you know, Mecca was my first sword instructor, and God bless him, he's gone now. And, you know, he was known as a movie actor, but people didn't realize he was Shotokan, and plus he was a great sword man. And one of the first things he taught me, he said, Gary, remember, it doesn't matter, you know, if it's a piece of paper or a piece of dirt or even a sword or someone that says you're something special. All that matters where it comes from and the heart it comes from. And I'm thinking, how much nerve someone has to call you up and act like they're mad because they're not invited to your Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, mm-hmm. That's what we've come to now. It's sad, isn't it, Dave?
Well, if you think about it, just the fact that they call or they email me that topic, it kind of sums it up in 1 second. I don't even have to say a word. It's like, well, there you go. That's why you're not going to get inducted, because you're not that type of individual. Again, it's kind of like what you said. It's not even about the paper, the awards. You know, we do put a lot of money into beautiful awards. It's more about, it's just real sincere. And I know you can ask, it's hard for me to say because I'm the guy to put it on, but I would encourage you to ask someone else that's been to mine. It's just down to earth. It's legitimate. It's sincere across.
Oh,
you
tell. I'm very close to Jamie Cashin. I'm very close to Mark Shuey. Dave, before I met you at that event that we went to in California, I knew who you were, and I knew where your heart was. And I'm only asking you this because people know me to be someone of a skeptic of Hall of Fames. I say that because the ones that you mentioned, I belong to too. And I support the ones that support the community. But I'm not very active in the fact of someone that would call someone up and say, you need to put me in because blah, 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 blah. You know, people misconstrued what I do. I'm not a Hall of Fame. We're an alumni. And all we do is support karate. We don't do the cultures or where exactly it came from. It came from America. We're all Asian influenced, but sport karate was born in America. So that's what I concentrate on. Now, I admire the other gentlemen that have put together other museums, like the one in Burbank, Mr. Masuda, and other people.
Right.
But I don't do that. I concentrate only on sport karate do. And I admire you for your honesty about saying you wanted to do something different. And now let me ask you a question. you rely on your alumni to nominate someone if they feel deserves to be nominated, or you go to that person personally?
No. And again, I know that came across, I could tell from my feedback, I got some feedback. I know it comes across arrogant what I'm going to say, but no, I don't want nominations because, and I don't know everybody, but I've been around a long time in martial arts. If I don't know your name, there's something wrong, right? I mean, I know almost everybody out there. Now, there have been people that I know real well that are already grandmaster level or they've been in it 50 years. There's been a couple of them say, hey, this guy, and there's been a few people I never heard of. So I did my research and found it. But most part, I don't need nominations because I'm not trying to make money. That's the other thing. I purposely don't, in fact, not to cry or give out too much information, but I lose a lot of money on my events. But that's beside the point. I do it for a purpose, a reason. And the second part is up to me to later. So it's not for money. So a lot of people don't understand why I'm not inducting all these people.
I'm not trying to do it like a business. The other day, that's the reason why you're on my show tonight, because you got to understand I'm bombarded too by a lot of people who say they do Black Hall of Fames, and I kind of avoid it. And I want you to know that I know what you do. So that's why you're on my show. That's why I'm sharing with my listeners that you do have a very special event. And the people that you have put in there are my personal friends. And I understand what you're doing, and I admire you for that. You know, I want to say also to you that, you know, having schools around the world, that pretty is incredible to me, especially a California boy who started, you know, as you did. That's pretty impressive. Now, staying humble, I know it's pretty hard, but that's what we all started with, the karate. We didn't start with a punch or a kick. We started with yes sir and no sir. I want to ask you, how do you really feel when you sit alone by yourself and think about it? You've got schools all around the world. That's pretty darn cool, Dave.
You know, I really, it really cliche, but it really does. It kind of knocks me on my butt because it's like, even to me, it's like, how did that happen? It's been going almost 15 years.
Do you have interpreters? If you tell me you speak Chinese and German and French, I'm going to.
No.
You have interpreters, right?
I do have interpreters, especially in Germany, but most of South America, I speak pretty good Spanish, and so I've done it so much that I can't speak like great fluid fast sentences. But when it comes to martial arts, I know everything from fast, slow, right, left, foot, hand, elbow, you know, circle, reverse. I mean, I know all the terms, so I can teach pretty good in Spanish.
Interested in this question, Dave. You say you got schools in China. I mean, that's a kung fu backyard, bro.
Yeah.
And you're doing karate how hard is that?
No, which is really weird. This is he was actually one of the first graduates of the very first elite black belt camp held here in California. That was tied with the most intense elite black belt camp I ever held. The second one would be in Uruguay, third one in Brazil. That went 4 days. And we trained 17 hours a day.
Wow.
Really intense.
Wow. Hours a day? Wow.
Yeah. We just sleep, lay down a few hours. I start cooking them a little breakfast, and I feed them 3 meals a day. But it's like a boot camp for SEALs or something. I mean, but it's for that purpose. It's we have a purpose for our system. It's not to teach traditional martial art karate. It's to teach people to be executive protection experts like bodyguards and the people that are doing special forces, close quarter stuff. That's what it's for. It's nothing like a traditional school. So it's pretty intense. But the guy in China graduated from my first camp, and he's been with me, and he's traveled on and off, and he keeps in touch with me. And he's actually trying to write a book on my – he's really good at writing books. I've been trying to. I don't have the time. So he's luckily going to hopefully finish it one day for me. But he just happens to be in China teaching for universities and asked me if it would be okay if he taught my system. He's thinking open a little school, and he teaches Wing Chun a little bit too. But anyway, so there it is. I've never been there. I have one in China. It's been there almost 2 years. I haven't been there. Still haven't been there.
Wow, that's cool. I got to ask you a personal question. because this is parts unknown, and if I don't ask the personal questions, I'll probably get fired. So here's a personal question. Are you ready?
Go.
Why aren't you in the movies? I mean, you're a pretty boy. Yeah, the talent
done,
you are,
done,
and the way you look, why
movies.
Haven't you been in
I've
the movies?
I did 14 movies.
Oh, that answered my question then. Tell me some of the movies you've been in.
My first movie was 1973 called Bloodsport, not the one everybody knows, but it was called Bloodsport,
yeah.
Two words. It was 1973.
So you was in the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie?
No, 73.
Was that Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, the Bloodsport movie that was Frank Gibson's life?
No, it was called Bloodsport, two words. Claude Van Damme did is one word.
Oh, it's one of those fake you out movies. Okay, I got you.
It was done probably 20 years before Bloodsport. Because it was done in 1973, and it had Larry Hagman when he was only I Dream a Genie. He wasn't JR yet. It had David Doyle from Charlie. It had David Doyle from Charlie's Angels. And it had an actor that everybody knows now, but it was his
right.
very first screen credit. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Gary Busey.
Really? Now, what year was that?
I was in the first movie. That was 1973.
73. Wow.
And the other the great actor that I know you know, one of the greatest actors, I was like in awe hanging around him, but he befriended me. And on the breaks, he would take me in his trailer with him and his wife. And that was Ben Johnson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Ben Johnson,
and
the consummate
ben
cowboy
ben
actor.
Ben Johnson and Red West and all those guys. I was thinking
yeah.
those guys. And Hal Needham, who did the first
Yo,
Cannonball
Needham,
Run
yeah.
movie.
I
was a group
right.
of that. By the way, did you know that Jackie Chan's first movie was the Cannonball Run in America?
No.
Yeah.
No, I did not
yeah,
know that.
Yeah, that was his first movie. And Hal Needham went from Westerns to do the Cannonball Run. And Ben Johnson was on that set, too. I'm so glad you mentioned him because I immediately think of Red West, and they're both gone now. And they
yeah.
were great guys, man. You know, those were the old Western guys. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Before,
I was so
you know, in the movies, you said you
back.
Did 14 movies. Remember before the blocking, before Mr. Norris and Dick Turso and all those guys were invented blocking when you didn't get hit, it was all contact in the stunt work.
Oh, yeah. I know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So
I've got,
what other films
yeah,
did you do?
Got,
any other movies?
I did with Charles Napier. I was a deputy.
Okay.
Charles Napier, he's dead now. But everybody knows. A lot of people don't know his name. But they know when I say he was the General Rambo, he was the guy that arrested Matthew Broderick and Cable Guy. I mean, he's always
yeah.
like the chief of staff in the military briefing room and the war movies. I mean, Charles Napier has been in a ton of movies. Anyway, did a movie with him, but it,
well, then you answer my question because I was, you know, because you're a good looking young man. I say young man because I know you're pushing at least 30, right? So anyway, I wonder if there's a movie you ever got the movie buzz, but you answered that. 14, huh? Cool. Well, you know, I tell you one thing too. You're going to do your last one in 2020, right? Where's it going to be at? Is it going to be in Fresno? Your Hall of Fame. Is it going to be 2020? Is it going to be in Fresno? Dave, are you there, buddy? We got a little blank space there, but I'm talking
hey,
away.
Gary, I lost you.
Yeah.
What was that question you asked me?
Well, I was going to ask
question?
You, where's your Hall of Fame going to be at this in 2020?
Well, it'll be in Fresno.
Okay, you're breaking
California.
Up again, Dave. You okay?
Yeah,
you're breaking up.
Yeah, it'll be in Fresno, California.
Okay. You got bad
back
weather
in,
there or something? Yeah.
You no,
bad
I'm
weather?
Way I'm way out in the country. So
that's a good
sometimes.
Excuse then. Yeah. Well,
It'll be in Fresno,
no
same place I've been the other two. It'll be in Fresno. It'll still be extremely classy if you ask the people who went to mine. You know, red carpet, black tie event, limousines. It's really high class, but it'll be fun.
Well, you say you don't charge for it. That's very unique because the gimmick today and the pay-for-fames that are around the country, it's a entry fee to buy your award, and then you have a design. You can buy a big award, a little award. You can buy a clock. You can buy – you have a choice of awards, and then you have like 237 categories to choose which award you want. And then it costs for that. You don't do that now.
No. Mine does have a fee, but and I've had a couple of people question me on that. And I say, I can tell right away. First off, I can tell you've never done one of these events because it cost about $20,000 for me to put this event on, with limousines and red carpets and the meals and the setup and the design people and lighting people, and I had a film crews going on this last one. I mean, people think, how can you do that without charging a fee? So my fee covers that and not even the whole thing. Like I said, I lost a lot of money every year I've done one. So their awards
the inductee doesn't pay anything to, all you have to do is show up? Is that what you're telling me?
No, they have to pay a fee. But that covers their – I mean, I have live entertainment. It's a full, beautiful dinner. I've got spent a lot of money on the event. I mean, it's like going to a big event concert or something in Vegas. You wouldn't expect to get in free.
No, of course not.
So,
what I'm saying, though, they're not paying for the award. They're paying for the event, the dinner, and the entertainment.
Exactly.
I understand. Cool.
Yeah.
Very good.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to explain. I try to explain that to so many people, and they don't understand. But unless you've done an event or been part of it, putting on an event, you would know it costs a lot of money to run one of those events.
Brother Dave, I've done the Living Legends from Starboard Rose for 26 years, and, you know, the minimum cost of throwing an event yearly is $20,000 or more. So I understand what you're saying. You have to recover your expenses. But I'm a firm believer, and I've never, never, ever in the 26 years charged for an award and all the awards that we've given through Living Legends. I'm very proud of that. And it's not me. When I created the History Generals for the Sport Karate Museum, I made a promise to Sid Campbell and Mako and Kim Knudsen. And these guys who are gone now, of course, Mike Stone, Alan Steen, J. Pat Burleson, Joe Corley, Sam Chapman, I can go on. These guys, I gave my word that I would never charge for an award. So, I admire what you're doing, and God bless you for sharing that with my listeners tonight. Hang on. I'm going to do a couple more things, and I'm going to bring you back, Dave, and we're going to close out.
Okay.
And I want you to tell people how they can get in touch with you and how they can maybe do seminars, get in touch if you want to do seminars and so forth. So give me a couple minutes, and we'll be right back with you, okay?
All right, got it.
We're with Sookie Dave Johnson. We've had an incredible show talking about all kinds of cool stuff. I really want to plug a couple more things before we get off our show tonight. Don't forget our next show, which will be June 26th, will be undercover agent retired, Mr. Ted Summer, who is an author and also a retired undercover police officer. In July, of course, we'll be live at the Super Show, and that will be with Jim Buten and Miss Linda Denley. On the 10th of July, we'll have Mr. Mike Wilmore, and that is Kickstart, the Chuck Norris organization. He's one of the major instructors there. Also one of the wild boys from the early days in Texas sport karate. So on the 17th of July, we'll have Mr. Johnny Thompson. That's right, Mr. Johnny Thompson, and the one and only memory that we have personally together back in the 80s. On the 24th, the great Carmichael Simon, the Kata King. And then the 31st, we'll end the month with Ashley Wood Tyler. August, we've got some great times. But listen, be prepared for the end of June and July with our special guest. On our segment tonight of I Don't Get It, I Don't Understand. That's right. It's Willie Hicks' segment, special segment. Willie Hicks, if you don't know, he's one of the top five fighters in the world. And he's got an opinion. And his opinion is very simple. This week, he'd like to talk about judges in the finals. He doesn't understand that if someone is picked to be a judge in the finals, they should be respectful, they should be honest, and they should be watching technical, power, speed, coordination, presentation, and performance of the kata. If that person won first place already, and he's in the grand competing against other first places, he should not change his kata to conform to the grands. He should go up there with the kata that he won with and compete against those other first places to decide who the first place is. If he changes his kata, then it's not the fault of the judges to give him a lower score, because the judges have judged him before in the daytime with a true kata presentation. The competitor has a tendency to change the kata to conform to make it longer. Well, most of the judges in the finals that are chosen know what they're doing. And if they see you change that kata, they're going to change the score. You're going to get a lower score. Don't try to conform your kata to the grand championships. Keep your kata the same. Mr. Hicks feels that judges are chosen because of the quality and the knowledge. 99% of the judges that get on stage in the finals belong to be there. They belong to be there. Tonight, we're just talking about kata. Our next segment is I Don't Get It, I Don't Understand, Mr. Hicks segment. We're going to talk about fighting, and that's going to be a little more personal. Because, as I said, Mr. Hicks is one of the top five fighters in the world. So remember, kata practitioners, don't change your kata just because it's the finals or the grands. And judges, stay the way you are. Judge fairly. And that's in the segment of I Don't Get It, I Don't Understand, by Randy Hicks. God bless you. Hey, guys, remember, we are the AMA Masters Radio Show. We've had our special guest tonight, Soaky Dave Johnson. Dave, are you there, buddy?
Yep, still here.
Well, thank you so much for being at tonight's show. How can people get in touch with you if they want to have Soaky Dave Johnson to come to your school or have seminars or come to Fresno and get in touch with you? How do they get in touch with you?
MasterDaveJohnson@gmail is probably the best way to get a hold of me. MasterDaveJohnson@gmail, real easy.
So are you home now or are you traveling? I mean, you've been gone for how many weeks in this Europe tour?
Been gone 19 days, just got back from Europe, different parts of Europe, did five countries. At least, I haven't counted yet, but I know I've done it at least 20 different cities in five countries. It was pretty crazy, but I'll be here for probably 3 weeks, and then I'm off to Hawaii to take a vacation for my vacation, and then I'm going to head to Peru and then Australia.
Wait, you're taking a vacation from your vacation.
Yeah, it was a lot of traveling, a lot of airports, a lot of buses, trains, subways.
You picked a great place. Just don't go to Hilo because of the lava.
No, I know.
Yeah. Have you been to Hawaii before?
I have never been to Hawaii. And Todd Dunn, my good friend, which you well
know. Three things,
Todd, bro.
Three things. Okay, very important. Okay. Number one, trust me, you have to go to a luau with fire dancers and hula dancers.
On my list.
Eat the food.
On my list.
Okay.
I have to.
Number two, and this is mandatory, don't go to Hawaii without going by the memorial tribute to Pearl Harbor. Okay?
Pearl Harbor, yeah.
And if you can, get an helicopter tour and fly over and see the battleships. It's so moving and so powerful. I know that you'll appreciate it. And you'll remember that Gary Lee told you to do that, okay? You got to go see the Pearl Harbor Memorial. And the last thing, it's four. But there's the third one, you got to try what they call poi. Poi is a paste, and it's
Get
it at the
luau.
Most people don't like it, but it's a traditional thing. And a spam sandwich. I'm sure you've had that before. But the last one, are you going into Honolulu?
I'm not sure yet. I haven't got my ticket, but I got a shout out to Todd Dunphy. Todd Dunphy's going to basically.
Todd Dunphy.
Yeah, I'm hanging out.
Hawaii, boy. Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. He'll
I'm going to hang out with Todd.
Yeah. Oh, man, yeah, no worries then. Just tell Gary Lee, Gary Lee gave you some bullet points. He'll take care of you. But a couple more things. You go to Honolulu, make sure you go to the North Shore, drive around Honolulu, and see the huge waves.
Okay.
That's important. And
I think that's
if
where
you like to shop.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not really sure where Mr. Todd is.
He's a North
Shore. He's a Hawaii boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he probably lives on the beach somewhere. I know he does.
Yeah, he lives right on the beach for sure, yeah.
One last thing, and this is really important. If you're a shopper, you got these little streets in Honolulu, really a bunch of them. You look down, and they're like 5-6 blocks long, and they're nothing but vendors. Now, I say that because they're all over the world, but these vendors are really cool. They sell a lot of the same stuff. So you can go from vendor to vendor to, you know, to haggle. You know, one might have it for 19, one might have it for 14. And I don't know, if you like to shop, it's a lot of fun to do that. So, God bless you, man. Go to Hawaii. Aloha, brother. Aloha.
Yeah.
And then you got to learn
to recharge.
Manga, stick it a boom boom, that's the pom pom. You hear what I just said? Cooking a manga, stick it a boom boom, that's the pom pom.
Wow.
You have no idea what I'm saying. That's cool. It's just the Hawaiian gibberish. Yeah. Hey, man, thank you for being on the show tonight. I thank you so much. And, you know, I appreciate what you do. And I appreciate how you showed me how you honor the pioneers and legends. And it takes one person
to
at a time
on the
like
show.
You.
Yeah. I wanted to thank you, too, because of what you're doing. You know, think about how many people are doing what you're doing. One. There's only you. You're the one protecting this history and kind of preserving it like Michael does in Burbank. I mean, you guys are just one in a billion to give the effort and the sacrifice.
He works hard at what he does, and I work hard at what I do. And, you know, we're very lucky to be chosen to do that. And I'm blessed because I got 250 history generals that I've handpicked and asked personally to help me. And so it's not me. It's never been me. It's been about everybody else. And I praise God that I'm in that position. But I want to thank you, Dave Johnson, especially Dave Johnson, for your time tonight and for spending it with me on the Masters Radio Network. And will you please come back maybe next year, maybe before the 2020 in your Hall of Fame, we can do a pre-show on who's being inducted. And
would be absolutely awesome. That would be a really good idea. Maybe
well,
2 to 3 months out, so people know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You can count on it. Count on it. Absolutely. Okay, buddy, so have a great night, and we'll see you, okay?
All right. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you next week with the Ted Summer interview and talking about what's it like being an undercover police officer and the life that he lived. And, of course, in his book, Ted Summer is also a Kempo practitioner. And, you know, this weekend I started with the Battle of Atlanta, and I'm going to end with the Battle of Atlanta. This weekend was very important because I not only got to see some of the legends of martial arts, I got to get personal artifacts that people let go because it's very personal to them. And they autographed it. And you know, people don't understand when someone gives up a uniform or a picture or a document and it's personal and it's been in their life for 30, 40 years. You know, I understand and I give my word that I will take care of it. Now, you have a Facebook page. It's called the Inventory Artifact List of the Sport Karate Museum. Just like that. The Inventory Artifact List of the Sport Karate Museum. And you can go there on Facebook. And you can actually see updated, and we just updated it, all of the inventory that we have at the Sport Karate Museum. And people don't realize that the heart of the museum is a belt that Grandmaster Gene Lee, rest in peace, who wore and gave it to Grandmaster Alan Stein, and he wore it for 4, 5, or 10 years. And he gave it to Mike Stone, and Mike Stone wore it for a few years. And then he gave it to J. Pat Burleson, and he wore it for years. And then Mr. Jim Harrison wore it. By that time, Mr. Harrison got it. It was white, tattered, and looks like a stringy white piece of string. Well, he gave it to me a few years back, and that is the heart of our Sport Karate Museum. You know, people don't realize that we are an alumni. We're not a Hall of Fame. We support Hall of Fames, but we're an alumni of unique people. We're all Asian influenced, but we're part and realize that sport karate was born in America. I encourage you to go to the inventory artifact list of the Sport Collider Museum and see the detailed information of the things that we've collected for the past 20 years and see some of the new items that was added after this weekend. And as I said earlier in the show, whatever you decide to do, Mr. Joe Corley, God's blessing. And I rely on you daily if I need something and a mentorship toward the Sport Collider Museum. I thank you for letting us be a part of the Battle of Atlanta this weekend. On behalf of the AMA Masters and Radio Show, we'll see you next Tuesday night with Mr. Ted Summer. As I've said for so many, many months and for 2 years, mahalo and aloha.